Colonel John E. Moray, Reserve, Director of Causeway Research Institute, Salt Lake City, Utah. John's background is in physics and pharmacy, with a major part of his experience derived from working with his father since the age of 16. His age, not his father's age. John's active in civic organizations. He's president-elect of a Kiwanis Club. He's listed in American Men of Science for his use of high energy in recovery of minerals, another of the controversial areas in which he happens to be and have been, and I'm sure will continue to be involved. He plans at least two books in addition to the current The Sea of Energy, which is available in the bookshop. Now I'm most honored to present to you, after having introduced him briefly before, that self-avowed radical conservative, John E. Moray.
I find it a very great honor to meet with you tonight, and I wish to thank you very much for the honor that you paid my father. I might just give you a little bit of background on myself and the Research Institute, now known as Causeway Research Institute. My father became very disgusted with the present business arrangements that normally take place, and I'll talk about this a little later on. And so in order to try and form a foundation, he formed a limited stock corporation and issued the stock as trust to the stockholders. And consequently, as a result, the corporation has always been very closely held. It's a family organization, devoted entirely to carry on his work. And we've gotten involved in many controversial things, and consequently, the outside financial help that we have received has been very limited. I know that there are many, many stories and impressions given. But, you know, we talk about the cost of research, and we get so involved in what it costs to do something. And someone once said to me, John, do you know how long it takes to spend $1 million? And all I can say is it doesn't take the government long at all. And research is right next to the government. I am tempted to talk about a large number of various subjects here tonight. The conference has been very stimulating, and I've heard a lot of very interesting ideas, none of which are entirely new to me, because we've been exposed to the full gauntlet of investigation. Maybe it is that my father, my brother, and I have an overwhelming curiosity of life. It is a great world. It's a great existence. People are the greatest part of it. And the ideas of people are even greater still. And so when you talk about therapy and the problems involved there, I've gone that route. We got into therapy quite surprisingly at the insistence of the United States government. And yet the recipients of the inheritance of the Department of Agriculture that used to run your drug regulations, the Food and Drug Administration doesn't like what their father did. And so we have not particularly been smiled upon by the food and drug people. And if I had time, I could go into this, although I won't. Except let me say one thing, that they won't stoop to any, they will not hesitate to stoop to anything. I've been criticized for having been involved in alchemy. And if that's what you want to call a photodisintegration reaction, this is fine with me. The word has no offense to me. I'm not offended by words. I'm not offended by most people. I'm often touched, but to say something has a bad stigma, it does not offend me. And all I can say is there are more things in heaven and earth than the mind of man can conceive, and Shakespeare was correct. And I am impressed with any wide scope of investigation. Because to say it is impossible is the only impossible thing. And as my father followed the impossible dream to his grave, he believed that radiant energy would be a boon to mankind. And though he touched on many other things, too numerous to mention, he could only see one thing, and that was radiant energy. Energy, as he felt, would be the most important thing in the world, because it was obvious that mankind was growing and energy would soon become in short supply. And even in the early 1900s, he had the dream of alleviating man's suffering by providing cheap, inexpensive energy. If you turn on the projector for me, please. See if I can get that in focus a little better. There are all kinds of forms of energy. I'm just amazed since this, quote, energy crisis, unquote, has developed. The number of things that we talk about in the energy world. Of course, to me, hydro power was always the greatest form of energy you could look at. My background, my father was intrigued by generators. They had a sound to him that was homey. He was at home with the sound of a generator. In Sweden, when he was studying and working there, he knew a fellow working in the generator. He used to put a meditate next to the generators. This particular picture comes from Yellowstone Park, if any of you recognize it, but I was raised with the impression of the great engineering feat done at the Hoover Dam. Which I grew up, I date myself and call it Boulder Dam. But I'm quite surprised I'm older than some of you here, although you may not believe that. The energy sources are wide and variable. Again, if I may use Yellowstone Park, geothermal energy. And I'm just amazed at all the problems it seems to be running into. And I'm not so sure that it isn't running into the same kind of problems that this particular picture depicts. In case you can't read it, the back there, can I get that focus on? The cartoon is not as funny as you might think. It really isn't, because this is exactly what happened to Maxim and his machine gun. They literally threw him out of the country. Said it wasn't worth having. So what did he do? He went to England. He was knighted by the Queen of England because he saved England's army during the Crimean War. Now, how we can look at anything and say we don't want it is ludicrous. Because it seems to me every little discovery we might see has some great value to us. The problem is in the viewer's mind. In a way, we've offended many people. I realize I offend people. I'm sorry if I do. Because I realize, as the scriptures say, offenses needs must come, but woe unto them by whom they come. It's not the offended person that is in trouble, it's the offender. And at the risk of offending the energy people, I'd just like to make a few observations. Somebody pointed out to me the headline on the paper. And I think it said $3.50 a gallon by 1990. Well, I heard an estimate in Sacramento, California last weekend where their energy fossil fuel expert predicted $5 a gallon by 1985. It's ludicrous, absolutely. I have the IQ of 75, but even I can read better than that. If it goes to this, it's because we let it go to this. I'm not going to say that there's a petroleum shortage. I'm going to say there is a very poor management problem. The exact date of Shell Oil's experiment in Canada on salt sands escapes me. But I do remember in the late 50s, about the time the Canadian dollar first hit parity with the United States, that Shell Oil proposed that they allow them to set up a tar sands plant in Alberta, Canada. A man by the name of Nathan Tanner in Salt Lake City was one of the major constituents of this proposal, that they were refused a license to do so on the grounds they would ruin the price of oil. This is in the late 50s, early 60s, was not later than 62, I'm sure. If the technology then was in such a position that they could produce cheap oil on a competitive level with the oil prices then, why can't they do it now? Recently, I read a book wherein they estimated costs of alternate forms of energy, and they pointed out in 1975 that the cost of converting coal to an oil product was only half then what it had to be, or the price that they could obtain was only half then what it had to be in order to make it profitable. They estimated that 23 cents, they called it a unit, I'm not sure if they were referring to a gallon, and they said if it went to 45 cents, then it would be profitable. Well, the price from 75 to 1980 has more than doubled. So I can't understand why it isn't profitable. If England lit their lamps in the 1800s, 1890s, with coal gas, why can't we do it now? Ronald Reagan pointed out a few months ago, and maybe he's embarrassed now because he has actually gotten where he wanted to be, that if we would use, just convert back the major industries that are presently using petroleum products back to coal, then we would not have to import oil. I heard a major oil company representative make the statement that we had to import oil at any cost. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, we can't afford to import oil at any cost, because any high school kid that ever went to Hong Kong realizes that dollars are our stock and trade, and if we keep exporting dollars, we're exporting gold, and we just don't have the financial backing behind our dollar to afford to import and export to. And I don't know where our present management people are coming from, because those kind of figures don't make sense to me. Research has always been the greatest challenge of mankind. Everyone always says that if you're a great innovator, you're a great researcher, and yet the world has always ignored the average researcher. It's nothing new. We heard about Josiah Coppersmith earlier in this conference. Somebody either read my notes or knew my mind. Let me mention Francis Jenkins. Do you realize Francis Jenkins demonstrated television in 1918 to the Department of Navy? And they rejected it as being a curiosity they could see no practical value to. Do you realize that Gustave Le Bon theorized, and it was not until I was rereading some notes that I suddenly realized why he was thought so. He theorized in 1890 how to produce and what the results of the nuclear fission reaction would be. I remember in 1940-41 when the Manhattan Project first got started. You that know dates better than I do can come up with some exact dates. But I can remember the FBI coming to my father's door and demanding why he was using the Salt Lake City Library copy of Le Bon's book. They took a book that had been out for 30 years and classified it top secret to help run the Manhattan Project. I remember after that my father started collecting any of Le Bon's work he could get, and we'd go to bookstores all over the West looking for Le Bon's Evolution of Matter. Le Bon was fought because he disagreed with Rutherford. And Rutherford was one of our great fathers of nuclear physics. That was the information I found out just the other day as I was reading some old notes. The picture I'm showing here is Kettering. Charles Kettering of General Motors fame gave to General Motors some of the greatest products they've ever had. Without Charles Kettering, you wouldn't have the modern lacquers for covering the automobile. Over the lacquer problem, and I'm afraid I'm taking too much detailed time, but the lacquer problem itself, they told Kettering, you cannot paint an automobile in one day. And Kettering said, we've got to paint an automobile in one day or we can't mass produce automobiles. And so he found in a lacquer shop in New York a lacquer that was just what he wanted, and he said, make me a quart of it. And the man said, no, I can't make you that much, it dries too fast. And he says, he went back to General Motors and he handed him about a 2-ounce sample, handed his staff, and he says, you people tell me you can't get it to dry fast enough, and this man tells me it dries too fast, you compromise between this sample and what we're doing. And so Kettering gave that to General Motors. He gave them the modern automobile engine, the way to cure the metal. Kettering made over 10,000 discoveries for General Motors. and yet he never completed his pet project to find out why grass was green. I am told that when he heard of the discovery of chlorophyll from spinach, he got so angry he rolled on the floor. Kettering, like the rest of us innovators, had a doubting mind. I can't blame people from doubting. You can't say that you don't sometimes doubt. Another great innovator was Nikola Tesla. Amongst this group, I would be surprised if most of you haven't heard of Tesla. But you know, when I talk to most people, the majority of the people don't know who Tesla was. The ignorance in the United States is overwhelming. I know people that never read a newspaper. I was talking to one lady, she's slightly older than I am, and she didn't even know who Rommel was, which as a reservist, that was quite a blow to me. Tesla gave us everything we use today in modern power transmission. Without Tesla, we'd be struggling with DC. Now, I understand there are people who want to go back to DC. But Tesla gave us the polyphase motor. Without Tesla's motor, we couldn't run any of our refrigerators. You couldn't run any of your electrical motor-driven devices. We'd have to have DC motors. Tesla walked away from Westinghouse with Westinghouse owing him more than $3 million. The man died in poverty. I understand from food poisoning. Some of you will hear other things. Some will hear other different stories. But my first impression was that it was food poisoning. And yet, the man literally gave his life to science. He would run out of Golden, Colorado. They burned his laboratory because he used to make the gas pipes spark at least half a mile away from his laboratory. The Wright brothers. Everybody recognizes what heroes the Wright brothers are. And yet, do you realize that if the Wright brothers hadn't gone to France and England, that we wouldn't have the Wright brothers airplane? Here's an interesting story of Edison. We all recognize Edison and the great work he did. And yet, do you realize he was an uneducated man, really, on the basis? I'm not an educated man per se, but he had less the formal schooling than I. I didn't mean to leave that one. The story is that when Edison presented the phonograph to the French Academy of Science, he was unable to go himself. And his representative went there, and as you see with the original phonograph, his representative had to crank the handle. And one of the Academy members jumped up and grabbed him by the nose. Well, what would you do if somebody accosted your nose? He quit cranking and the machine quit working, and he said, "Look, that proves it's ventriloquism. He can't do it with me holding his nose." And they threw the man out of the Academy. What my father contended was that there is energy everywhere. And when he read Tesla's book that was published in 1909 on the experiments of high potential, high frequency, my father was convinced that it really was a sea of energy, because here is a great man that agreed with his ideas. And I think in 1909 this gave my father the real stamina and courage to carry on. His mother was very much against his research work. She insisted he go to business college. And he struggled in the basement. He would go and raid the garbage dumps. He did anything to stay in electronics. She finally bought him a small electrical firm so he would get involved in the business and forget research. After he went to Sweden and had the opportunity of studying in Uppsala, Sweden for a few months. He was convinced more that research was the only thing in his life, and that energy was the only thing that he really wished to work for. And so with this vision, he returned to the United States and began his work, really in great effort. This energy, this sea of energy, he was convinced, and this is why he took the name, or gave this to his book, it was a sea of energy in which the earth flows. Originally, he wondered at a time if it was ground energy. But in his research, he came convinced that it is energy throughout all the universe, and that the earth is only floating through this energy. This idea gave him quite a bit of opposition, particularly since they proved that there is no such thing as an ether. But I think the space industry has proved there's no such thing as a pure vacuum out there in space either. So whatever we want to call it, today we do know that the earth floats through a lot of things. This is my father at approximately 20 years ago. He had a great sense of humor. His training at Uppsala led him as an electrical engineer. He did a lot of work as an engineer. He was listed in an astounding number of different books, Who's Who in the West, famous Utahns. His work as an engineer was crowned by the fact that he built the largest and was the designing engineer for the largest oil-cooled switchyard in the West at the time they built it at Terminal just west of Salt Lake in Utah. Terminal was built to support the copper mine business by the Phoenix Construction Company for the Utah Power and Light. Although the Utah Power and Light later used to deny that he ever worked on the project, I still have the original drawings with his name on it. He felt about engineering like this picture. He was stuck at one time to work right after the First World War as a civil engineer, and he knew that it was going to kill him, because both designers on both sides of him smoked cigars. And he couldn't breathe, so he thought if he took up smoking a pipe, this would defend himself a little bit. But then he'd end up looking like this picture, which says at the bottom, "Ye faithful engineer." So he gave up civil engineering and continued on, and finally got his job with the Phoenix Construction as an electrical engineer, and continued his work. In 1936, after forming a number of companies, he formed the Research Institute, and in 1939 became the senior consulting engineer for the Western Division of the REA, at which time he built this laboratory entirely with his own finances. I've talked about most of that, except to mention the fact that his first actual experiments he performed at the age of 9. By 1909, he used to get an arc between two carbon electrodes. His final energy accumulation, as Tom Durden has already mentioned, amounted to 50,000 watts of power drawn on a 55-pound unit, about 18 inches long and 15 inches by 12 inches, no larger than that. His unit was definitely high frequency, and as I've already mentioned, Nikola Tesla, he felt that Tesla really channeled him to continue on with his work. Although many people accuse us of being majorly, Tesla followers Dad's work really didn't follow the Tesla type research, because Dad's work was solid state. Here I show a Tesla coil that we built in the early 60s. We used to use this as the primary power source, and that's the only reason why we built it, was so that we could get higher voltages than we had then available. But Dad's work was basically solid state, as I mentioned. Here is a 1927 drawing, wherein he had it certified and notarized, wherein he describes what he called his Mori vow. The Mori vow being, as this drawing shows, a germanium doped semiconductor. Now, the drawing here gives rise to a lot of debate because of all the extra wires he throws in here. It's the description of the device that becomes important. We don't mean to be paranoid. Sometimes I really think that I am. But on the other hand, I think I have cause. And I think my father had cause, because no matter where you turn, there's always somebody trying to borrow something. And so consequently, all his drawings, such as this one, are encumbered with a lot of extra lines, and so we were often criticized. But if you look at the lower right-hand corner, this particular drawing, drawn in 1931 and certified to by many witnesses, actually proves that he had a bipolar semiconductor. The word transistor being Bell Laboratories' own design. Here are copies of the patent application. The patent was rejected on the basis that it didn't use a heated cathode. In other words, the examiner said a transistor wouldn't work. And so on this basis, they rejected this particular patent. His radiant energy patents came for similar argumentation. The pellets, as he pressed them and put them in, are unique in their way of putting together. Bell Laboratories came up with their extruding method. Tom mentioned earlier that his method of producing is not being duplicated. I know of one firm that did research for the Army in semiconductors that presses their semiconductors in a similar manner. And they make the statement that they can make an N-type or a P-type out of the same material, just depending on the pressure at which they press them. And this cycle varies several times through the pressure range. Here again is a copy of the rejection, as I mentioned it already. The actual size of his device to drive a radio was that of a wristwatch. These are actually the back of wristwatch cases in these photographs. He used many various ways to mount, but he found that if he used a metal case, insulated the inside against an insulator, he could mount his devices and put it together. This particular wristwatch-sized radio would drive a loudspeaker without the use of a battery. Now, I hired a young man one time who had just gotten his PhD in physics, and he got really irate when I told him the original crystal set didn't need a battery. And he really fought that problem, and he went home to Southern Utah to see his father, and he asked his father about that. And to quote his father, and I've got to say Stan really was honest when he told me this story, he said, Stan, do you mean we've spent all this money and all these years to get you a PhD and you don't even know how to make a crystal set? Here is an actual description The actual description that was given to Carl Eyring and Harvey Fletcher of Bell Laboratories. Harvey Fletcher, although it is often denied, was the head of the department that developed the transistor. His name is on the first request for material to be used to build transistors. Here's a picture of an actual radio he used. He called this his radiant energy radio. In Dad's attempt to try to explain to Dr. Fletcher and Dr. Eyring and Dr. Marshall, Milton Marshall of the BYU, how he and why he built semiconductors. He built the original transistor radio, or germanium valve, as he called it, to show that he could build a synthetic crystal set. Then he built this radio to show that he could build a crystal set that produced a usable amount of power. And with this particular radio, he could bring in Bird from Little America with no outside power source, no batteries, and he could bring Bird in. And I run into people today that tell me, well, John, when I was a boy, I heard your dad's little radio. And this was his analogy to try and show how a semiconductor worked and how his radiant energy valve worked. He had to go to what he called a tube version of his valve in order to come up with the 50,000 watts of power. However, in examining his tubes, these tubes really were semiconductive devices mounted in a specific environment. We do this with many semiconductors today. The semiconductor today, many of them still use cat whiskers for specific applications. We don't sputter all our semiconductors. The point is, the work was very well documented. I have literally hundreds of letters from people who saw the device operate, both reputable and non-reputable people. They flocked to him like flies to honey. He would find people at the door representing all kinds of nations. We never left the house that we didn't expect to come back and find the back door kicked in. It was a continual stream. So consequently, he always had to tear down his device, hide it, and the next time he'd be working on it, somebody'd come along and want to see it. The letter I just showed you, I show because this particular E.G. Jensen gave an adequate description of how the device worked. You see in the upper part of the picture an antenna lead. Coming into the antenna lead, there's a light bulb connected. The light bulb never lit at that position. If that connection was broken, the machine would cease to operate. But the light bulb at that position never lit, showing that it was not a sensible type electrical current at that point, although it could be run through capacitors. And it was during a duplication of this experiment that the unit was destroyed by a man we'll mention later on. He powered the device off of this antenna. The antenna that was some 70 feet in the area and 100 yards long, 300 feet long. The base of the antenna ran right next to my bedroom window. That's how close I grew up to it. You can see the antenna going into the building. He was accused of boring a hole 70 feet through the center of the pole. And that's how the electrical energy got into the antenna. In the original Sea of Energy book, I used a picture of a cat being combed, and I say this is the source of electrical energy. There were other stories circulated. One of the stories said my mother used to run back and forth on the carpet, and that kept the energy going. This is one of the early devices. This is a 100-watt device where he couldn't draw more than 100 watts. The biggest problem was he used to burn out his device all the time. His valves were expensive. He could only build two out of 100. He had a 2% success factor in building these valves. In the early semiconductors, I understand they didn't have any better success than this. And so in his desperation, he had to go to something with a little more power and a little different approach. And finally, he got to the area where he could prime the device, begin to draw a little power, and then switch it into a larger circuit to draw more power with a relay system to drop it out on the surges. The relay overload system led to some of my fondest memories. This particular picture shows him working with the device. You can see the knife switch and the tuning device. He has his hand on the tuning device, and the pilot light next to the switch. Now, he was accused that he was the only one that could tune it at this point. It takes Morey to run the device, that's what people used to say. So many times, he used to invite spectators to start it up. They would prime it. They would turn the dial until the light began to light, and then they would throw the knife switch. Sometimes it took longer than others, but anybody could run the device. This is the particular device we used in all kinds of experiments under all kinds of conditions. It was tested under every conceivable working condition my father could come up with. He went out to an area called Strawberry because they said it was induction. So they went out 30 miles from the closest power line in the Strawberry area and tried it out there. I went out recently and took this picture. It's now the Strawberry Reservoir, but you can see the desolate open country. This didn't satisfy the critics. The scientific people that he had hired to help him get a patent. You see, this is how Harvey Fletcher and Carl Eyring got into the program with Milton Marshall. They were hired as consultants to work on the project to help him get a patent. This was supposed to be in addition to their jobs. Carl Eyring worked for the BYU at the time, along with Milton Marshall, and Harvey Fletcher worked for Bell Labs. Right after that, Carl Eyring left the BYU and went to Bell Labs. Dugway Proving Ground was the most desolate area in Utah, so they went out there. Those were the days before Dugway was out there. The reason why the Army went out to Dugway was because they said there was nothing out there they could kill, and it literally was that desolate. Even the sagebrush didn't live well. This is taken from the top of the ridge at Johnson's Pass, which you can still see how desolate the desert is out there. The area was known as Skull Valley because more animals and more people died of thirst and heat exhaustion in that particular area than any of the other particular Utah desert. Literally, if you go out on the salt flats today, you can understand why, and this is just south of where the salt flats are located. The original unit was destroyed in 1939 by a man by the name of Felix Frazier. Felix was hired by the REA to do an evaluation of the device. I don't wish to get involved in political arguments at the time, but let me just simply say It's a matter of congressional record today that the Rural Electrification Administration, under the Department of Agriculture, was a communist organization in 1939, 40, 41. If you read the articles published by Accuracy in Media, they absolutely prove that the so-called red herring investigations that were soon shut up were correct. I know this for a fact because I looked through it. Felix Frazier said he destroyed the device so my father would no longer be harassed to make demonstrations and run the risk of losing his patent rights. The Attorney General of the United States had ruled that regardless of what the circumstances were, demonstrations still caused the loss of patent rights, which most amateur inventors don't realize. If you show it to your wife for fun, you've violated the patent law and you do not have a patent right. It says for personal pleasure, convenience, or profit, any demonstrations are a violation of patent law. We have the notes. I can adequately go through exactly what took place. I like to show this particular picture because it shows the device in all of its three modes, heat, light, and power. You see the 150 watt lamps on the outside of that light bank with 100 watts in the center. Many people testified how bright the lights were, and yet they were cold to the touch except for one point at a set degree away from the cathode. It would produce heat. It would raise a flat iron or a space heater in a matter of seconds. And the little blurry thing at the bottom was a high-frequency motor vibrating at such a high speed that they had a hard time tying it down to take photographs of it. The clip in the upper left-hand part of the picture is the antenna lead. If the antenna lead was disconnected, you got an 18-inch brush discharge. As I mentioned before, a light put in the circuit at that point would not light, but the brush discharge could be produced. And Dad used to say, and if you moved your hand wrong, it loosened your teeth. When Yakovlev came from Russia, Dad was showing Yakovlev the brush discharge, and he got hit. And Yakovlev laughed. If you know the Middle East and Oriental mind, discomfort is funny. So Dad let Yakovlev play with it for a while, and Yakovlev got hit, and he groaned. And Dad said, well, I knew it had happened sooner or later. He thought it was funny when I got hit, and it was funny when he did too. But the brush discharge showed the intensity of the current. Just figure it out yourself, you amateur physicists. High frequency, the number of volts per centimeter it takes to get an 18-inch discharge. This particular photograph I used because it was a photographer and his testimony of how bright the lights. This is such an unusual phenomenon that it made it difficult to get any kind of picture. I use this particular one because this is A.B. Jensen. And A.B. Jensen was hired by the Utah Securities Exchange Commission to investigate it. And they called Dad because when the old Mori Products Company went defunct due to embezzlement by the major officers, to the corporation. Dad formed the Research Institute, and they discussed selling stock. And so the Securities Exchange Commission wanted to have a demonstration and have their experts examine it. And A.B. Jensen was a excise battery expert, and he came down, and as Fletcher had done, he tested every individual part of the device to see where there was energy. And he found there was none when the device was not operating. The examiner still wasn't satisfied. And so Dad told him, well, he says, I guess I'll have to tell you the truth. The thing that is wrong is that I've got ribbon batteries in the 2x4s that make up the base. And if you'll bore a hole, you'll find them. And so Dad got him to bore a dozen holes with a bracing bit in a 2x4 18 inches long to find the battery. And after a while, he finally got the message and he says, oh, you're joshing. E.G. Jensen was the man that saw the Dugway test. He knew that Herbert Hoover had sent a representative, and so consequently he gave this letter showing that Dr. Fletcher had insisted that it was induction and that it had to be tested further and further away from existing power lines. If you can get that kind of induction, let's have it. That's all I can say. That's transmission of power without wires. That'd be great. Here is the letter by Robert Judd, again pointing out Dr. Harvey Fletcher's connection with the device. Judd at the time had been Dad's attorney, and Judd was the man that got Fletcher to consent to work on the project. Many people used to say that Fletcher denied any knowledge of the device. In fact, I have letters that state this. This friend of mine, Glenn Foster, went down to talk to Dr. Fletcher and found in Fletcher's old age, he's 90 now, that he's maybe repented of his former attitude, and he readily admits seeing the device operate, although he makes the statement the device was operated sitting on the floor. And he couldn't tell for sure if there was induction or not. Well, as you've seen the pictures, how the device was operated, it's strange, but Dad always used the same table. I have that table today, if any of you want to examine it. He always set it up on a table. But Fletcher says it was a great idea. It should have been developed. Murray O. Hayes, his patent attorney, makes the statement that he knows that Fletcher would be able to duplicate it, that Fletcher had been shown everything, and that he himself could have duplicated it if he'd had the time to work on the project. Again, a picture of the patent attitude that the examiner wanted proof of a source of energy. There is no such thing as energy. I find people who tell me that right today. And I make that statement and other people say, well, of course there's energy in the universe. We all know that. Here's the table I'm talking about, and here's the radio that became so famous in the area because Dad used to play it. People from all over the neighborhood would come to listen to the news reports because he'd pick up wireless communication from the South Pole. Many people say, why didn't somebody get behind it? I can't really tell you why. In Dad's notes, I find this telegram to the old Maury Products Company I mentioned. when Scatty Farnsworth and Hayes borrowed the money from the corporation and put it in bankruptcy, and Dad sued his own company to put it into receivership, and was granted receivership by the courts in Nevada and exonerated of any wrongdoing, he found this letter in their files from this outfit in New York. He was never able to run it down, and as you see in his own handwriting, he says, for some reason, the deal fell through. Dr. Hayes never informed Maury as to what took place, so Dad never really knew. I've heard all kinds of stories. This is about the same time the story got started that Dad had sold out to the GE. So why he was never able to get the financial backing was never really quite clear to him. I do know at one time the Fisher brothers from Fisher Body were very interested. However, here it bogged down, and he was unable to get it through because of the old Maury Products Company. In fact, that was one of the reasons why it precipitated he sued the company. Another reason why the work has never been developed is the political reason. This particular letter is a Senator Bennett, after I got out of the Army the first time, and finished all the college that I cared to finish up. In 61, we decided we'd approach NASA, so we went to NASA. We got some of Dad's old friends from the REA days, a Dr. Craig, to help us. We got an introduction to NASA through the congressman in Utah, and we made a presentation. On the 24th of July, and the reason why I can tell you it was the 24th of July, 1961, NASA called Dr. Robert Craig, and Dr. Craig called Dad and got him out of bed, and it, because the holiday on the 24th in Utah that isn't a holiday anywhere else. And Craig said, NASA has just called me that they will take the program at $5 million, and they're going to furnish $2.5 million on the top, and if you meet your valve goal, they'll furnish the other $2.5 million. And that's what we were asking for as a research fund in 61. By 8 o'clock our time in Utah, or 10 o'clock back here, the project was dead. Dr. Craig tried to find out what had happened. The head of the Appropriations Committee was Wallace Bennett. I went to my friend and fraternity brother and put it on the line to him that Bennett had killed a major project for Utah. He wrote Bennett's campaign manager, who wrote Bennett, and this is the letter Bennett wrote back. And the only thing I like to point out here is he makes the statement, well, it's only $50,000, and do you want your government to buy a black box? He doesn't deny that he killed it. The issue was that he killed a $5 million project. He didn't deny that he killed it. He just downgrades the amount of money, and the, why should the government buy a black box? Here, theoretically, is a schematic drawing of the device. Now, wherever you see a figure, number, these are semiconductors or tubes that are major units. Actually, in the large unit, there are twice as many semiconductors as you see there, all of which are his own construction, all of which had his own variation. These devices are even today unusual devices. One of the silicon diode type devices that would approach what he made starts at $12,000 each on the present market. They're experimental units only. Many hypotheses. Tom mentioned Wheeler this morning. Lanzos. I personally follow the space, time-space relation, geometric dynamics. That makes most sense to me. Everybody chokes upon hypothesis, and this is why we started the contest for $1,000 as to why we should have various, or how could such various energies be produced. An explanation of how did the device work. This offends some because they've got to assume it did work, and I think I've got adequate proof that it did. I particularly don't care how it worked. It did work. We know how to reproduce it. And when I obtain sufficient financing, we will reproduce the device. I made the mistake of saying rediscover in the book. When I say the word rediscover, you've got to remember my father was an innovator and in some ways not a scientist. It's like the first time my wife and I went to stay with her brother's children to help out because they wanted to take a vacation and didn't want to take the kids, so we went up to the house and took the three children before we had any children. And my wife said, well, how much Clorox do you put in your laundry? As my sister-in-law was explaining how she did it, and she said, well, you just take the bottle, turn it over quickly, and let it go glurk, glurk. And this is how my father often did research. His notes specify one part this and two parts that, and you assume what he meant by a part. Well, I know what he meant. I know he meant equal parts. The total volume didn't mean anything to him. He was not raised with measuring cc's. And so, as an amateur chemist, he was not. But because he got involved in physical chemistry, per se, we have to sit down and figure out the pressures, the temperatures, the volumes, and many of the little things that my father took the attitude, I know what I mean, why don't you? I know one of the last arguments I had with him just a few months before he passed away was, why did he need quartz? He was so adamant on it had to be quartz, and today I can tell you why he needed quartz. Then I couldn't. And I used to go that rounds with him because I didn't understand why it had to be quartz and why, best of all, it had to be blown quartz. He specified blown quartz, not a cast quartz. I was raised and learned Utah by traveling from one general delivery post office to the other general delivery post office because in building his devices, no one in the United States could handle the quartz. So he would build a device and send it to Germany where they made the quartz. And then they would mount his device in the quartz envelope. Then they'd send them back to him and he'd make a few modifications. They'd send them to England where they had the capability of sealing them. But because he didn't want the first people to know what the modifications were and the people doing the sealing wouldn't know what the first parts were, he divided it up and this always went to general delivery under the name of J.C. Kane to all over Utah. And that's how I learned Utah as a little boy riding in the back of the car. If you want to say it's electrical earth field, why not? My father was convinced it was not the electrical earth field, but there's literally thousands of amperes of energy from the earth. He could get it to work on a portable antenna. If people doubted his outside antenna, he'd rig up between two glass semiconductors. Again, look at the brightness of these little lights. So bright that the photographer had trouble overcoming the intensity of the light. Again, I want to mention that table. People ask me if this was me, this young man holding the motor. No, it's not. But I saw the device operate many, many times. In fact, the very last test that was ever made after Felix Frazier destroyed the large device, Dad salvaged enough to make a small unit to work off a small antenna. In working on this device, I remember this was 42, we went to Denver and set it up in the Denver Park. We had run it all the way over the Never Summer Range, all the way into Wyoming, through Colorado, in the back of a car, running it all the way. He had turned it off when we got to Greeley because he didn't want to leave it in the car overnight. So he turned it off and dismantled it, and we went into this little hotel in Greeley. But when we got down to Denver, he was unable to get it started again. I remember his disappointment because he had promises from Spears that if his experiments were successful, Spears would back it. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the name Spears, but Spears was a very successful chiropractor in Denver in the early 40s. Dr. Spears' reaction, I'm getting ahead of my story. He couldn't get it started. He was using the most primitive diode he had, but the only one he was able to salvage. Now, I remember my father asked, my mother asked him to come have dinner, finally, and I said, Dad, I've eaten. I'll stay with the device. If anything happens, I'll come and call you. My impressions to this day are very great of how red it finally started to glow. You could see it almost heat up like a heater as the lamp began to receive a little current. So I ran and got my father, and before I could get him back there, it was in full blossom, that light of bank, that bank of light right there. Here again is the motor. Dr. Craig of the REA, who was Dad's immediate supervisor, to the day he died, continued to contend the government knew that Dad had radiant energy. But as he points out in this letter, those records all disappeared in the early 40s when the REA first came under investigation, during the war emergency years. Here are some official photographs taken by Felix Frazier of the RE radio and how it operated. Actually, this is the diode he was able to salvage to use on his rebuilt one before it finally burned out. Here's the original contract by the Rural Electrification Administration, signed by Carmody. Here's Ben Krim's statement that he knew that the mag deals, some of our early American communists, were the ones with the commissioner to get the contract signed. And here again is the contract. I show this because S.E. Bringhurst, the first president of the corporation, spent his entire life backing my father. And I thought in 71 it'd be a good idea to get S.E. to say something, so I got him to give me a certificate of what he'd seen, and the certificate all bulleted around this picture. The motor there is not operating, so they could get a clear picture of it, of the demonstrations he'd seen. And S.E. gave me a sworn statement in 71 of what he had actually seen. I have many such affidavits. These two are only a few. I've had affidavits come to me since I started giving this lecture. I had a chiropractor from California send me a letter telling me, John, I was there with you in the park in Denver in 42. I wouldn't have remembered if it hadn't been he identified himself. And he told the same story I just told you. Chester Todd thinks my other research is redundant. He said, John, why do you waste so much time working on other things? Well, he forgets I've got to eat. But Chester gave me a sworn statement on this. The only difference is Chester and I have an argument as to when this was taken. But this illustrates the conditions in which my father worked under. In those days, in 1937, we didn't have enough money to heat the basement, so he had to wear his overcoat to do his research. And so there you see him with his overcoat on, working on his device. Chester says this was in the early days of 37, and the way I remember it, the laboratory downstairs in the basement was remodeled in 37, and so this is why we have a few months variation as to when this was taken. Here again, as you see, Chester says February of 1937. Ladies and gentlemen, all I can say is I know there is energy. That this energy, like the sunset, is there. I have seen it. I have worked with it. I have been with it when it first began to make things work, like I said in Denver. We in the United States are ignoring the greatest source of energy that there is. It's possible. There are others doing similar research. There are others coming up with ideas. All I can say is I hope and wish them the greatest success. But I also, all I can say is when they come to having success, they better not do what my father did, but they better go looking for publicity and for support from everybody they can get, because if they stay in one small place, the same thing will happen that happened to my father. The GE first made the statement. Parrish of the REA made it again. But the greatest thing that interrupted the work was the fact of what they said, by the time we get through you, nobody will believe you ever existed. And this is why the world does not know of radiant energy. And this is why I'm on this crusade to tell the world about it. In writing the book, I have tried to give the most accurate picture of my father's work that I could. I may have offended a few. I hope not too many. Because I took the most important things I could remember. I know my father got involved in many, many areas of research. Again, he may offend a few, the least of which was not his therapeutic work. And therefore, I can sympathize with your problems with radiomics. However, I am not ever apologizing for what we have done or what we did. But my brother and I have dedicated our lives and every dime that we can raise. My brother has been very successful in business up to now, in the real estate business. And we've spent a lot of money since my father died in trying to continue this work. The day will come when somebody will wake up and the amount of money that we need may be made available. The day also may become when some bright young engineer will make a liar out of me, and that won't hurt my feelings. Because when I say, as Tom quoted, it'll take $5.5 million, that was a few years ago. You look at the inflation figures, and I think we're talking more like $9.5 or $10 million today to duplicate what my father built. Some bright young engineer may do it for 35 cents. And I will apologize for giving such a high figure. But all I know is how it was originally built in the first place. I am not the great mind my father was. I do not see the innovation with modern science technology in order to reproduce it. I want to thank you again for the honor you made me. I do appreciate it. And all I can do is give you a promise. That as long as I live, I'll continue to push this research work. Thank you very much.